Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I'm not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I'm someone that doesn't drink alcohol, and I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. Like right now. I want to start by saying a big happy soberversary to Lisa. Lisa is one of our longest standing strivers, and she's now gone 2 whole years since having a drink. Well done, Lisa! There you are. There's me clapping Lisa. And we want to also say congratulations to John and Tracy, who have gone 1 year of not drinking any alcohol. John is a Truth About Alcohol ambassador. Tracy's been with us for a very long time. Happy 1 year soberversary to you two. And one last thing, one last clap of the hands to Craig. Craig's one of our Truth About Alcohol ambassadors, and Craig has celebrated his 1 year Striver birthday. So John joined Strive a year ago, and he's still going strong. What I love about Craig is, you know, he came to Strive, struggling a little bit, did the work on the taster and the intensive and so forth, and now he's helping other people do the same in his ambassadorial role, and it's really great. And I was lucky enough the other week to meet a bunch of these Strivers. First of all, I was in Las Vegas. I was in Las Vegas working, and I got to meet Surf Chick, got to meet Holly. She came over from Hawaii, not to see me, of course, but she was there to have a bit of fun. And yeah, I got to see her and her lovely husband, Mike. So that was fantastic. And then when I landed in the UK, I went to Birmingham, and we met up with Serena, Julian, Sue, John and Craig. It was our first UK meetup. We had a really wonderful time. And I tell you what, one thing that I noticed, and I'll share this with you, is they all looked beautiful. What I mean by that is their skin tone, their face, everything. They all looked really, really healthy. And I don't really know any of them. I didn't know any of them when they were drinking. So I don't know what they looked like when they were drinking. But I guarantee they didn't look as healthy as they look right now. They all look very, very beautiful. It was really, really wonderful. And we're working on setting up a UK meeting in London very soon. Going to go down there and meet Tony. And I'm hoping a load of other Strivers will join us. So there you are with that. So who are we going to talk to today? We're going to be talking to Liz Tominey-White. Now, Liz is the partner of Vinnie Grant, who you would have listened to last week or the week before or whenever that was. So I met Liz same time as I met Vinnie at my friend's birthday party in a Middle Eastern restaurant. And like I said, when I met Vinny, I thought his energy was amazing and fantastic. I think Liz is equally amazing and fantastic. Liz is a people problem solver. She says she helps interesting people find success in meaningful work and relationships that they love. And she's got a book out called Unstuck, Stop Wondering and Start Living. We had a fantastic discussion. We talked about, what did we talk about? Narrative psychology. We talked about mapping. We talked about the importance of be, do, get, and how people like me, for example, I'm always trying to do stuff, right? I'm always trying to do stuff. So if I want to be, if I'm upsetting Liza, my wife, like, what do I need to do to stop kind of upsetting her? Whereas Liz was teaching me, now, who do I want to be? What is the type of person that Liza needs me to be or I want to be to stop upsetting her? So be, do, get, very, very important. What else did we talk about? We talked about how important stories are and the story arc and how, you know, learning stories very young and kind of relating deeply to a story will follow us through our entire our life. We talked about and used the idea circle, which was really interesting. Just learn to say what you want and stop assuming stuff all the time. Be who you are and how important that is. So we talked about a load of stuff. I think you'll really, really enjoy it. If you want to find more about Liz, you want to work with her, then send me an email at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I will hook you up. In the meantime, if you want to join Strive and you want to learn more about the wonderful things we're doing there, then we've changed to a subscription model. It's now £40 a month. So send me an email at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com to join our exclusive little family. And get to meet each other online, get to meet each other live, get access to every single video we got out there in the Taster and the Intensive and soon to becoming Cave experiences, so we can all help you to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol. I'm going to shut the hell up and leave you in the capable hands of Liz Tominey-White. Welcome to the Alcohol and Addiction Podcast. Liz Tominey-White, how's life?
It's very good indeed. Yeah, very good.
So you're a people problem solver, and I'm a person with a lot of problems. So tell me, how did you become a people problem solver? What does that mean?
Life experience, I think. It just means that we're pretty much every problem's a people problem, right? You know, if there's a problem with a supplier or a problem with somebody in your team, or there's a performance problem or a problem with something at home, you know, unless it's something easy like the sink's broken, then it's usually a relationship problem. It's usually a people problem. So what I'm really good at is working out why people do what they do and what their intent really is. So the biggest mistake people make is to assume that other people think the way they do, and they don't at all. And so you think, well, why are they trying to make me feel like this? Well, they're not trying to make you feel like anything. That's just the outcome of what they're doing, which is something entirely different. So I'm really good at working out what they were trying to do in the first place, helping them do that so they can stop making the other person feel however they're feeling.
So you said two things there. Why? So why are they doing it? And what's the intent? So
yeah,
let's start with the why. So how do you even begin to ascertain the why behind a people problem?
So I guess because I've solved so many people problems, it starts to have a bit of a formula to it. So say there's a problem at work where somebody's not performing, or they're in late, or, you know, there's some kind of issue there. Usually it's either because they've lost the desire to work in the place that they're working for, or that they've got something going on at home. And you can pretty quickly work out which is the case. Usually by talking to them is the best thing. Usually I end up talking to the managers, who have a slightly skewed view of things. Mm-hmm. But if you ask a few other searching questions, like, you know, what else is suffering? So that, you know, have they had any big shocks? You know, they've just suddenly been divorced or lost a partner or a dog or something. You know, if there's something else going on at home, then you can quickly work out what's going on. If it's a work thing, then usually you're going to need to speak to the person and try and work out what's going on. And everybody's in this sort of fearful mode because they think, well, people will be scared of losing their jobs. But actually, people just want to be happy. Most people just want to be happy. And if you call people on it and say, look, you know, you're a great person, but you're not doing great things here, what's up with that? Most people will level with you and say, actually, I've always wanted to be a ballerina, or, you know, I'm just not happy here, or I don't know what to do, but, you know, this doesn't feel like it. And I seem to attract people who are at those crossroads in their lives. So I do a lot of narrative psychology about the different stories we tell. And they're usually at one of the crossroads. And there are different sort of camps of stories that people tell. So there are the childhood ones about overcoming monsters. There are the teenage to sort of 20s, which is rags to riches. So leaving home, finding the princess or the prince, and finding your kingdom, which is all about finding your place in the world. And then there's the quest, which happens. You're supposed to be living happily ever after rags to riches. And then people are all like, oh, I'm not living happily ever after. And either they do a complete about face, which sounds like what you did, which was yours is a fascinating story. I love telling it to people. Or they do the more common thing I find, particularly with senior people, they trap themselves. And so they've got a nice house, they've got nice cars, they go on holidays, the kids go to nice schools, and they feel like they're locked into this job and this, you know, that they can't be the thing that they want to be, or they can't do something more meaningful because that's the price they pay for having a nice lifestyle. And actually they feel a bit guilty that they're not happier about it.
Okay, so you mentioned the narrative psychology, and you talked about a few different, let's call them...
They're stories. In the book, I call them maps, the story maps.
Story maps, yes. We'll come to that in a bit. So, you know, I have a daughter who is close to being 3.
Who's adorable.
Adorable. I mean, look at this. I mean, we got like, you know, I mean...
See, that's lovely. I was never into that when I was little, but I think it's... Do you know, I've got 2 boys, Lee, so I've missed out on all this princess and dressing up in...
So that was the unicorn one. This is Elsa from Frozen. We got Belle from Beauty and the Beast downstairs. So, of course, Zia, when she's not like most of the 99% of the time, Zia actually functions in a fairy tale world. So
yeah,
like she wants me to be a prince. She wants me to marry her. She wants to be beautiful. She wants to put a dress on, et cetera, et cetera. She even understands that every single story has a villain. And we will talk about, you know, in order for it to work. So when you talk about narrative psychology and you talk about the quest and the fairy tale and all that kind of thing, are we talking about real, true life events? Like, is what is happening with my daughter right now, which is going to be with them for the rest of her life? Or are we talking some kind of psychobabble that we created in order for us to make sense of maps, et cetera, et cetera?
No, genuine, real story. So I'll give you a really silly example. I had this thing for ages about not wanting to lead people. And I did some the narrative psychology work on myself. And it's very, very simple. We can do some with you if you want. So you think of, from your childhood, what are the stories you can remember? Not that you liked, but just what can you remember? And one of mine was Chicken Little. You know, the thing where the chicken runs around, the sky is falling in, the sky is falling in, just because he can see the sky in a puddle. Yeah. And then he runs around and gets all the other animals to agree with him that the sky's falling in. Don't worry, we'll get out of here. So they all follow the chicken. And then in the end, they meet the fox, who says, "Don't worry, I can save you all. Just come with me." And comes into the cave and the fox eats them all. And I was, I was so traumatized by that story.
Right.
But in my mind then, what I locked in was leadership's dangerous. You could lead people to their death, and you need to watch out for cunning foxes that speak in that way.
Right.
And so for ages, I had this thing about people, particularly men, male characters that were particularly charming, that spoke very well. I was always slightly wary of.
You wouldn't have liked me then.
And then the leadership thing, you know, I was quite happy managing people, but if I had to create a direction and say where we were going, it filled me with this nervousness. And it was kind of tied to the confidence thing, you know, which I talk about a lot. So that's kind of my big thing, I think, is confidence, really. It just hits everybody everywhere. And it's the one thing that just sets you free.
It's funny because Liza's mum says that when Liza was growing up, her mum said to her, "All men are wolves." Not foxes, wolves. So she must have watched the Red... She must have been... She must
Red
have been,
Riding Hood.
Yeah, she must have had the Red Riding Hood narrative. Oh, let's have a go at me then.
Yeah, go on then. So think of a childhood story. What's the first one that comes to mind?
Childhood story that comes to mind is actually
one. You don't have to like it.
It's actually one I read my boy. Does that matter?
No, it's great.
The Hobbit.
Whatever comes to mind. The Hobbit. Okay. And what do you remember about The Hobbit?
What do I remember about The Hobbit was two people going on an incredible journey against all the odds. People who you would never ever perceive to be leaders in the world whatsoever, complete underdogs, and lots of flowery crap writing, which I only appreciate now.
Excellent. Yeah, I tried to read The Hobbit several times as a girl and I could never get into
it's tough.
I don't mind the films now, but I still it reminded me of the Bible, you know, like so many years ago, the league of this and the league of that and the family of this and the clan of that.
Yeah, it is hard.
Right, so now I can cheat here a bit because I know a bit about your lifestyle, but I would say to you, does that resonate with your life that there's this journey that you need to go on and it's the most unlikely people?
Not only does it resonate with me, as I was explaining it to you, cognizant of the fact that it was very similar to my journey. So I categorize myself. I have a story that I'm a northern working class gumbag who is no better than any other human being in the world, a little bit like the wildlings from the north of the wall in Game of Thrones, and to get divorced and lose everything and become a writer, interviewer, help people quit alcohol is just insane. I see myself as an underdog, and in a way it's good because like my journey has led me to where I am, but it's also limiting because it hasn't enabled me to go further.
Okay, so I would then say, look at that story. So the story has the Hobbit and he goes to lots of different lands, right? Which you've been to lots of different lands. So the parallels are incredible. It's amazing how this stuff works. So where is the Hobbit limited? What can the Hobbit not do?
What can the Hobbit not do?
Think of the other characters in the book.
So the Hobbit isn't magical. The Hobbit isn't strong in terms of physical strength. So he has allies to help him to... So he has Gandalf, which helps him with the magic. He doesn't know how to get to where he's going to. So Gandalf, he's kind of knows where he's going. And then he has the really handsome kind of guy who chops everybody up for him. he has allies.
Why don't we make the handsome people the fighters? That's a worry, really. Brilliant. So therefore, it's telling you that there are certain things you think you can't do, but you're wired to believe that other people will do them with you, for you, collaborate with you. So you'll seek collaboration, and that's how you'll do the things that you currently see that you can't do, where you're limited.
Or if I don't see collaboration, then I tell myself that I'm limited and I can't do something.
Yeah, and then you'll go into Hobbit mode. So you'll retreat to your house, make yourself a cup of tea and tell yourself you didn't want to go there anyway.
And toast. Don't forget the toast. Yeah.
And the toast.
I actually sometimes use a, it's not a Hobbit, but it's a Lord of Rings quote. When feeling down, I say, I feel like margarine spread too thin over toast. I actually use that quote. That's remarkable. That is so interesting. Folks, if you're listening to this, you should try this yourself.
It's funny how it works. So, then you've got your rags to riches so you think of your teen and 20s kind of films, but also these might be films that are still appealing to you now. And they're where you, it's usually where a young person sets out to make themselves in the world. And they can be, some of them are kind of fairy tale-y, you know, like the Pretty Woman-y kind of stuff. Lots of the kids' stuff nowadays is quite rags to riches, more than overcoming the monster. Like the princessy stuff that Zia will be into.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of, so like your Moana is a classic, you know, at the moment, if mine are into that, you know, and they're boys. and then after that is the quest type story, which is that, you know, I don't know whether you're into sci-fi, and so I like The Matrix and things like that. So, you know, where there's a quest to go do something, to be something different, to bring something back, usually for the benefit of not just you, but everybody else. So rags to riches is quite selfish. So you're making your place in the world, whereas the quest is, who else can I be? Where else can I be? How else can I be? And looking at, you know, what's next? What can I do that's meaningful? Mm. And that's, to be honest, where the bulk of my clients are, is on that cusp that they should be living happily ever after, but they're not. There's a hole. And you know, I think alcohol is the obvious thing people turn to at this point. You know, I've got a hole to fill. I don't know what to do about it. Alcohol really helps. And the reason alcohol helps is because it seems to cut off the future and the past, and you're just now. And actually, in this moment right now, everything's okay. And I don't have to think about the fact that if I fast forward what I'm doing now into the future, I'm deeply unhappy. And so I'll just stay here in Groundhog Day. And it's kind of, it's like a reverse time machine, I always think of alcohol as. You don't travel anyway, just stay now. Which, if you know, if you could just stay being mindful, then that would be cool. But, you know, it doesn't work like that. It becomes a way, an escape and a way out of thinking about it.
It's like you're mindlessly in the now. You're not going anywhere.
That's a really good way of saying it.
Yeah, you're mindlessly in the now. And I think before I used to, so if I was drinking, before I used to lose the plot, so before I used to black out or semi-black out, the past would come up a lot for me. So it would be, I would moan and groan, or it'd be an excuse for me to complain, or sometimes reminisce happily, but
interesting.
Yeah, but no, the Matrix is a big one for me, because of course you know, at Strive we believe that alcoholism is an invisible, violent and dominant belief system. In a way, it's very similar to the Matrix, where Neo, before he's exposed to the Matrix, thinks the world works one way, and then it's revealed to him that it's not, and everything changes. And what we do at Strive is we reveal to people that actually alcohol doesn't provide you with any value. It's an illusion, and everyone's like, whoa, and everything changes for them, you know? So,
I mean, I think the work on connections another big theme for me, along with confidence. And I think the stuff that the Portuguese government did recent, I don't know how recent it is, to be honest. I was hearing about it on a TED talk, I don't know whether you've seen that one. There's so much stuff out there. And he was talking about how his brother was addicted. I'm not sure whether it was alcohol or cocaine or what he was addicted to. But anyway, he was addicted and he didn't know what to do. And he went on a bit of a quest trying to find out what to do. And meanwhile, it seems the Portuguese government had a similar quest going on where it got to the point where 1% of the population was addicted to heroin. You heard that statistic?
Yeah. Not that statistic, but I am aware of Portugal's reform and how
that's
wonderful
amazing.
It was.
I was just blown away, really, by the idea of that they were open-minded enough to say, actually, what we're doing isn't working, which, you know, for politicians, I think is pretty stunning. And then to just get a load of psychologists and scientists and everybody else and say, well, what do we not know here? And then, you know, taking all the money away from the drug war and funding that and just putting it into rehab and connection. And, you know, that they came to the same idea, and this guy comes to the same idea at the end of his talk, saying that alcoholism, drug addiction, all of them seem to be this sort of deep desire for connection that's somehow been thwarted somewhere else along the line, and that they can't get connection, and therefore excuse me, alcohol or drugs seem to be a way of filling the hole.
But yeah, that's
search for God.
That's Johan Hari, and we actually cover that TED talk in our intensive our lessons.
Cool.
He says that the opposite of addiction is connection. And I even push it even further and go one layer deeper and say communication, because without effective communication, you cannot connect. So, like, that's one of the things I'm struggling with at the moment. I understand that Liza, my wife, needs connection. I understand that I need connection, but not as much as Liza. But it's my inability to communicate that will allow me to connect. So we went one layer deeper. Also, one other thing, just going off on a tangent, then we can come back to my marital difficulties. Portugal, not only did they basically legalize drugs and made drugs available to everyone, but at the same time, they produced a series of reforms and did a lot of work around improving people's quality of lives and connection, like Liz just said. So basically, drug addicts didn't want to take drugs because they had no need to anymore.
Yeah, it fell in half in like 3 years
it was
or something.
Crazy. And the other thing they've just done, which is incredible, coming from Cardiff, is that they are in the middle of making it law that every citizen in Portugal is entitled to housing.
Wow.
To eliminate homelessness. So they're doing that at the moment, which is pretty cool. I know,
who's in charge there, but yeah, all power to the robber.
It's amazing. It's amazing. You walk down Cardiff city centre at the moment, and it's getting diabolically bad, and it's difficult because you don't want them to go anywhere. You want them to leave. It's like you look at them and you think they're a stain on my city. I don't feel comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. But they've got nowhere else to go. So, you know,
yeah, they don't want to be there either, mainly.
No, something needs to be done. So I like, well done, Portugal.
Yeah, well done. But what, do you know what I mean? Why have we not copied them? This does drive me mad. When people solve problems globally, why doesn't everybody else go, do you know what? Smart idea, Portugal. We should do that too. And pick up the policy.
Resistance, I think it is. Like,
I don't know. Focused on the wrong things.
So, super interesting stuff. I like all that stuff. You'd got a book, Unstuck, Stop Wondering and Start Living, and you started your book with a quote from Marianne Williamson, the type of person who, if they did get into power, would probably try to fix something like that.
Do you know she is running? She's senator in one of the US states.
Yeah, Liza is big on her, so she's always telling me. But I'm not quite sure how great she would be as a politician, but I mean,
no, I don't get
either. Can't get any worse than the one they've got currently. But and you wrote the quote, what I think I should do depends on who I think I am. Can you just explain why that quote spoke to you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, again, it's connected to this, who are we being the whole time? So the narrative psychology is about who we're being. And so is this. So if people often say, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I should do next. I don't know what to do about this. You know, I don't know what to do about my relationship with Liza. Well, who are you? And if you think about who you're being, that will drive your action much better. So I have this little three-word process that is be, do, get. So who you're being will drive what you do, what you say, and will give you the results that you want, that you're looking for, right? But unfortunately, what most people do is they try and do get be. So they think, if I could just say these things, or if I just hold Liza's hand, or if I just tell her she's beautiful every day, that should work, and then I'll get Liza to think that I'm a great communicator, feel really connected, and then I'll be connected. Yay, that'll work. No.
let me just jump in there. Let me just jump in there to strengthen your training a little bit with a real life example. So me and Liza kind of fell off the marriage rails a couple of days ago. So we're currently going through it at the moment. And on the be do get thing, one of the feedback that Liza said to me was, I feel like a to-do list item. She said, I know it's not your fault, but you're the type of guy who has to put in his phone every 30 minutes, call someone that close to you because you love them. So your be do get, it's kind of like a sledgehammer smashing me in the face right now, because what I'm doing is I'm saying to myself, holy shit, like, I don't want to be alone. I don't want to upset everybody around me. I want to be a great husband. I want to be a great father. What do I need to do those things? I need to tell them I love them. I need to buy them stuff. I need to take them places. I need to clean the house. I need to clean the bedroom, et cetera, et cetera. What you're saying is I need to be. So let's focus on that a little bit. What do I need to be?
Right. So with the be part of it is what you believe about yourself. What do you believe about other people? What do you believe about the world? And that causes you to do things. So my big mallet to the head was, when I first read about this, was, we will never fight for our dreams. And I was like, no, what do you mean we'll never fight for our dreams? And I think, you know, my passwords are usually something about dreaming for the top and all this sort of stuff. You know, I'm big on dreaming. Don't tell me that. But we will fight to save our absolute base standards. So if you want to become something different, if you want to do different things, it's not about dreaming a bigger dream. It's about having better standards. Oh my gosh, that was such a smack in the head for me. So with this, and this is based on your beliefs. So what does, if using your example, what does a great husband and a good father, what do they believe? What do they like?
Okay, so right now I'm caught in limbo land. So I have my old beliefs and new beliefs that I'm trying to cultivate. So it might come across a bit all over the place. But from back in the day, I would say a good husband would be someone who takes care of you financially, someone who is strong, someone who has a good job, someone can like give you everything that you want in life.
Someone, wow, sounding like a genie from a lamp to me.
Someone who's a great dad. But now obviously I'm thinking that a good father, a good husband is someone that sees you, someone that hears you, someone that makes you feel like you're an important part of his life, that you that what you do and talk about and behave matters. What else would I say? Presence, listening.
Okay, so you're going again into do mode.
Oh, right, okay.
But so what do you believe? What do you believe as a good husband? What do you believe about your wife?
Oh, what do I believe about my wife? I believe she's the greatest mother I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I believe she's a pain in the ass. Just being honest.
Yeah.
I believe she's always telling me what to do.
Right.
I believe she's beautiful.
Yeah.
I believe she's incredibly intelligent, both IQ and EQ. I believe she's funny. I believe she just absolutely adores her daughter. I believe she wants to make a difference in the world. I believe she's an anarchist. I believe she's someone who would go to Iraq and stand on a line to stand for what's important to her, irrespective of getting shot.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Okay, great. So most of those beliefs are perfect for a long and happy marriage. So the believing that she's a pain in the arse and believing that she tells you what to do, which is fascinating because remember, you feel like she tells you what to do and she feels like she's an item on your to-do list. So I think therein lies the challenge within the relationship is how do tasks get done and, you know, whose job is it to create tasks? There's a great Adler has this great philosophy. There's a brilliant book. I'll try and remember the title of it before the end of this.
Adler.
Yeah, Adler. I was trying to remember his, there was a great book and it was a conversation between him and a young man. And it was like having the confidence to be disliked, something like that it was called. And the title struck me because I thought I never want to be disliked. So that really struck a chord with me. Mm. I'm definitely a people pleaser. If that's, I have a problem, that's definitely one of them. And he was saying that you get into the thing in life where you think relationships are hierarchical. So you think one person tells the other what to do. And then the person who's being told should be grateful to the other person for being told what to do. But there aren't any hierarchical relationships. It's all just an illusion. All there are equal relationships and you must get your joy from doing your good in the world. And it's not your job what the other person does back, which is nice, a really interesting thing. So if you get into this praise and blame kind of relationship where you're thriving on either being told off by the other person or being praised by the other person, actually you're in a bit of an illusory state because nobody's in the power to praise or blame each other. That, you know, you're just doing what you're doing. And their praise or blame actually is reflecting themselves and not you anyway,
right?
Which is fun. So in this scenario, I would say what you need to be is to embrace those beliefs. Have her just unpick those ones around tasks and being a pain in the ass. If you believe that she's intelligent and fun and all of those things, she would naturally be somebody you'd want to call, right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
If you were finding that you were spending a day and you were never calling her and you were away, then you might think, oh, that's weird. Why am I not calling the person that I find the most fun and interesting?
I could tell you why that is. I don't call anyone because they're not on my to-do list. I'm so busy that I have to, if I don't segment my life into blocks of time, including here's a block of time I'm going to spend with my wife.
Yeah.
Then I lose my shit, I think.
I think that's okay. But then in your block of time that's called relax and connect.
I'm never relaxed or connecting.
Right, okay. So there's your thing. So my diary, I'm with you, by the way, on this chunking time thing. So in my diary, I have sleep. And I also have relax and enjoy kids as a block of time that happens every day between about 6 and 8 when I cook them dinner and we watch a movie together or we just sit and chat or whatever. But I'm not trying to get anything else done then. That's me and my kids' time. And now, you know, with Vinny, I'm finding actually I need to find a way to get that into a way of making things happen and prioritizing that so I get to spend nights on my own, you know, and have some time there. So, you know, we're all getting these challenges, but it's making it a priority. So if your belief is that the main thing that you want to be is a great husband and a great father, then, you know, that's got to be a slot in your diary. Somebody once put the awful thing to me and said, I can tell exactly what your priorities are. If you give me your bank account and your diary, I'll tell you what your priorities are.
Yeah,
horrified me. I was like, no, please don't judge it from that.
I think it's like I fill in this journal every day, right? And yeah, it's become clear to me over the last week, especially since I've been having, like, you know,
these challenges,
marital challenges, is that I'm not the guy saying I need to make my family a priority. I'm the guy saying, if I don't make my family a priority, I ain't going to have a family. And I think they're two different things. And I struggle with this. So I think when I end up in family time, very often I'm thinking to myself, I'm doing family stuff but I should be doing something else. I want to be doing something else, right? And I think that goes back down, that goes back to my youth, whereas my mum and dad never really spent any time with me, so we never really had family time. So my quest to fill my time was never anything to do with my family. It was always like, is there football on that I can watch? Can I play with me mates? Can I play video game? Can I find someone who's got a video game console that I can play with him, because we were poor? My challenge at the moment is when I get my diary and it says one thing that I can get excited about today, I go to write, spend time with my family, but I feel like I'm being inauthentic, like, because that isn't what excites me. And so I'm in a real bit of a pickle at the moment, because nobody wants to live or spend the rest of their life with somebody who thinks like that.
No. And I think all that's happened is that you've just stopped giving. Oh, my cats just hissed at each other.
Scared the life out of you.
You've just got into the trick of using your incredibly creative mind at work, and you haven't used it so much, you know, with your wife and your daughter, because they're brilliant on their own. You know, your daughter's got a million princess dresses to wear. You know, the kids have got so much entertainment now. They don't need us in the same way, really, that we needed attention when we're younger. And actually, being bored is a good thing that you shouldn't deprive children of, I firmly think. And equally, your wife, you know, she's got her own business to develop, she's got, you know, Zia to play with, she's got friends. She doesn't need you to entertain her. She wants you to want to. And this is the massive thing about everything I do, that you can't help people that don't want to be helped. So it's about wanting to. So when you met her in Vegas, and you were so persistently chasing after her, you know, you really wanted to then. And so you need to get hold of that feeling again of, I really want to get her attention. I really want to see her laugh. I really want to make her crazy about me and think those. And that, you know, who you're being is the, so you're at the moment, you're being the busy, successful guy.
Let's just call it the busy guy.
Now, if you're not successful, that would suggest that you need greater efforts. But I think you're busy and successful, so don't come down that
day. No, what you just said then, something that like was that was like a bit of a light bulb for me, and I made a note of it. Was, I'm incredibly good at being super duper creative with my daughter. So when it's Zia time, I'm very good at it. So I will get all the toys out. We will pick a story. We will choose all the characters, and I will get into that. I will devise games. I will dance with us. I'm great at that. But when it comes to Liza time, it will be, do you want to watch Stranger Things? Do you want to go? Like, Liza's always saying to me, what the fuck do you always want to take me to the cinema for? I don't want to go to the cinema. Do you want to go to the cinema? Do you want to go out for a meal? Do you want to go to theater? Whereas Liza, she would want me to take her dancing. She would want me to create a music video for her. She would want me to say to her, let's just go in the sea and just splash around. Like, let's go horse riding through the hill. Like, it's
nice.
It's completely, and I'm not doing those things because I'm taking it for granted. It's like you said earlier on, you know, sleep, you know, work, the kids, making dinner, and then Vinny, right? You know, it's like, in my first marriage, I took my wife for granted, and she left me, and at the moment I'm kind of like running that same risk because they're like an adult, and I had this kind of thing in my head, like, just fucking get on with it. Get on with life. Like, just what's the matter with you?
So again, so there'll be patterns running for you around you know, what's normal, what happens in, you know, your archetypes, those sort of characters that you've seen from childhood. This is what happens in marriages. So, you know, giving yourself a few different archetypes. So reading about marriages that have lasted for ages, and, you know, what keeps marriages fresh. One of the things that there's another great TED talk by a sex therapist. Oh, such a funny talk. And she's interviewed loads of people around the world and says, you know, what keeps everything, you know, fresh and alive kind of thing. And she came to the conclusion that surprise, so people, you know, doing things differently, not seeing each other all the time. So being away actually was a helpful thing. And seeing the other person doing their thing. So seeing the other person at work or seeing their work was also a really good thing because you're not a part of that.
Yeah.
And it's quite sexy to see them, you know, in their element doing their thing.
Mm.
So they were quite good at pieces of advice as well. You know, I think the biggest thing will be that you want to. Like, she wants, you know, which is what everybody wants. She wants your attention. She wants you to want to be with her.
Mm.
And I think if you get back to that feeling, you know, and having kids is the worst depressant of all of these feelings, I have to say, because there's these sparkly little creative things that, you know, can entrance you and take up your attention. And if you're not careful, it takes your attention away from the very person that you created them with.
Massively. My mother's brother died yesterday. So, I went out for a meal with my mum and my dad. It was like a belated Father's Day thing. And, you know, like I just said to you, we had no love. Like, no. Love was not demonstrated in an affectionate way. So I'm writing in my journal yesterday, I have to spend time with my dad. I have to speak to him. I have to talk to him. I have to be there for my mum. I'm pumping myself up that I have to do these things. I don't want to, by the way, but I'm writing them down that I have to do these things. And then I get there and Zia is running around the place. She has to have my 100% attention of why she's going to die. Like, because she's right trying to run in a car park, etc. And because I'm just wholly focused on it, like it happens all the time, I don't even get a chance to speak to my old man. I don't get a chance to speak to my mom. And then I leave and I think, what a waste of time that was, you know? Kids are really, really difficult. Really, really, really difficult.
You see, and we're priming them just like you were primed when you were younger. You're priming her. So, you know, you've got to have some empathy for her poor husband who is going to have to live up to you now and 100% entertainer.
And be a prince.
Moment. Yeah, an entertainer in every moment creatively. Poor guy.
I know.
Hey, you're setting him right up here, you know.
Just to prove that I'm not always the great. I mean, she just woke up and she was asking me to pick her up and I'm like, I'm not picking you up, dude. I'm not. I ain't picking you up. And she was like screaming and crying, following me around. I'm like, I'm not picking you up. I'm fed up of picking you up, right? My back is hurting. I'm not picking you up. So I don't always give in.
And there was another time 2 years ago when...
yeah. So talk a little bit about getting the maps down. What are maps?
So the maps were just these ways of describing these sort of blocks of journeys that we have. So when we're younger, these overcoming the monster journeys, and the themes there will follow us. So I have this idea that runs through the book about it's like you're in a car, and your sat nav is happiness. Unfortunately, we just turn the sat nav off because we think it can't be that easy. And religion tells us that we shouldn't strive after happiness, and all sorts of things say we shouldn't just try and be happy. And yet, if we turn off the sat nav to happiness, we just try and find other ways to be happy. We think alcohol does it, which it doesn't, sadly. You know, or we think having lots of money will do it. So my favourite metaphor at the moment is life is a game, but it's not Monopoly. Mm. You know, the person with the most money and the most cars does not win. Otherwise, all the rich people will be happy, and they're not.
Yeah.
So, but what is the game? So I use the game reset quite a lot, like you were saying with your program. I imagine that I'm in a computer game and that everything that I think has existed up until now is just a memory that's been installed in my head. I have the resources I have because I can see them. I know the people I know, and I know what I know about the world. So what is the object of the game? Now, if I think about how I play any game, one of the things I want to do is explore the territory. So, you know, where else could I be in the world? What could I be doing? You know, the object of the game is rarely going to be, okay, how much money can I make right now? It's going to be, you know, can I acquire, you know, I like the magical games. Can I acquire some new spells, or can I do some new cool things, or, you know, can I go and see something that's really cool, or can I connect to somebody who's really cool? And those are the really valuable things. So these maps just show you the kind of stages of development of what's important to you at different times. But if you don't deal with them, you lock up those issues in the boot of your car. And so say when you're a kid, right, all you wanted was love and some attention. And you were told, no, you can't have attention. You know, that's not what you should have. That's the wrong thing to do. So anything that mum and dad didn't approve of, you will naturally edit as a child, because all you're seeking is your mum and dad's approval. So that is overcoming the monsters is all about, you know, what are these character traits that I have that I should lock up because mum and dad don't approve of them? So for me, I grew up in a very Catholic family. So anything that was at all risque, other philosophy, you know, anything vaguely sexual, that was all a definite no-no. That was definitely to be locked in the boot of the car. And I was a very successful child. You know, I was, you know, very academic, very, you know, holier than thou kind of thing as a kid. But I didn't have many friends and I was bullied, which is probably a result of locking up all the bits of my personality I could have done with. But anyway, so those parts of you, during that overcoming the monsters, you also find saviors and aliens. So the aliens are the people that are just totally different. And there's a lot more aliens in the current children's literature, which I think is, you know, testament to what's happening in society, that we're allowing people to be different and who aren't the same. And it's becoming far more tolerated, at least, but even embraced in, hopefully, as we go forward. So these aliens and saviors, so who saves you? You know, in the old stories, it was mum and dad or God that saved you. But now in the new stories, it tends to be other people that save you, which is far more realistic, I think. I think it is other people that tend to save you, which then leads nicely into rags to riches. So when you become a teenager, you then don't care what mum and dad think anymore, and you transfer all your allegiances to your friends, who sadly are as much of a psychological mess as you are.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
And then the only goal is to fit into the group. And again, the desire is to not be excluded from the group. You know, our biggest fear as humans is that we're going to be abandoned. So this will be pressing all your buttons right now with your wife, especially as you've just lost a family member as well. That'll just be heightening it. You know, and it's not a coincidence, I would say. You know, I think we attract these things in life because we're trying to show ourselves something. We're trying to show ourselves there's an issue here that we're not dealing with. And, you know, if we keep not dealing with it, we keep it locked in the boot of the car, then actually the universe just ups the ante until we pay attention. So, I could go into another story there, but we could go off on a whole another tangent. Anyway, let me carry on with the maps. So that's the rags to riches map is that teenage to 20s map. So you go and you find your partner, who's somebody who completes you in some way. And it's usually to do with the fact that, you know, you grew up with one side of the brain and they grew up with the other side of the brain. So if you're logical, analytical, you'll find somebody who's musical, relationship, creative, fascinating, and likewise. And they can't believe the other person's interested in them because they value the thing they don't have. The thing that we have naturally, we don't value because we think everybody's got it, but they don't.
Right.
I thought for ages that, you know, I was really good at encouraging people and I thought that was such a lame skill. I thought everybody, you know, everybody can encourage people and go, yay, go on. But actually, as the older I got, I realized, no, actually most people have got no idea what other people are like, never mind able to encourage them on their own terms, and suddenly realized, oh, actually this is quite a useful skill.
Yeah.
So then after rags to riches, then we go on to the quest. And so at the end of rags to riches, generally, if you're going to have a family, you've got a family by now, you've got a career or your first career, and you're then starting to become dissatisfied with the whole thing and you're onto a quest. So from what you're saying, I think you've done your first quest. Like, who else could you be? You found out you could be a writer, you can go around the world, you can meet fantastic women in Las Vegas, have a family, you know, on a whole different level than you had a family before. And you've kind of got to the end of that journey and you now again should be living happily ever after, and you're beating yourself up that you're not, doesn't feel like enough. But it's not time to throw in the towel and say, well, let me just throw everything in this life away and I'm going to start a whole nother life, which you could do, which will seem tempting at times, I'm sure. But the thing to do now is to find out what is the next quest? What is the unanswered question for you? So just like with The Hobbit, it was about discovering new worlds and, you know, that whole journey. if we looked at the rags to riches stories and the quest stories that stand out to you, we're running, not got masses of time left, but if we did that next, that would be the next thing to say, okay, so what are the themes standing out here? And it might be that that you really want to make a difference, you know, this truth about alcohol and all this stuff that you're doing, you know, you really want to make a difference that's tangible somewhere. So if you could get your head around and your, you know, some numbers around that, you know, what are you trying to do here? And what does that look like? And then in order to do that, you need your stable base, you need your family, because you need balance in your life. Just like you need to keep physically working out as much as reading, you know, you need to spiritually connect as much as you emotionally connect to people who are alive right now, you know. And I think that will then, that neatly takes us back round again to Liza, and that's what she's looking for, is that connection, that feeling that when she's with you, all of you is there, whereas at the moment when she's with you, probably 50% of you is on another task still.
Yeah, definitely. Even to the point that I said to Liza, I wonder if I've got pre-Alzheimer's, because I forget things. The amount of times that Liza says to me, I told you that. Like, it's just becoming ridiculous. I'm just, you know, we have fights over me saying, you didn't tell me that. You haven't told me that. And she says, I have. I just can't remember anything. Now, I don't know if that is neurological or not. I'm not even going to try and find out. But I'm kind of not with it. I feel like I'm going through what Seth Godin calls the dip, which is something, again, we cover in our intensive experience at Truth About Alcohol. You know, it's like you stop drinking alcohol, you feel, woohoo, I'm Superman. I'm there, I'm nailing it. This is really easy. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is boring. This is boring. Like, I don't feel like as good as I used to. Is this what life's going to be like? You go through that dip, right? Yeah. And I think the excitement of, wow, I don't have to be a railwayman for the rest of my life. Like, and then the unbelievable knowledge that, well, I don't have to go somewhere and sit there for 8 hours and then come home. Like, I can go to a coffee shop with my laptop and someone will pay me. Like, that, those things are like unbelievable. Traveling around the world, unbelievable. Meeting a new woman, unbelievable. Having a new kid, unbelievable. But now I'm in that dip. I'm kind of like, things aren't moving as fast as they should be, blah, 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 blah. What's going to happen? Too much uncertainty and getting a little bit lost.
So how do you stay on it after the dip? How do you?
I mean, part of, it's not a question really. It's just a waffle. But part of it for me is, like, yesterday, Liza said to me, how was your day? And I said, really difficult. I had to write 4 articles for clients. I really didn't want to. And I just had to sit down and get through. I just had to sit down in front of the blank page and I had to power through it. I had to stick some music on. I had to power through it. It was awful. I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. But I did. I look back. I did a 5,000 word article yesterday, which is a lot. A lot of words.
That's a lot of words.
It's a lot of words. And I've read it back and it's really good. And I feel great that I've done it. But I'm not in the process of it feeling great. Like, I have to power through it. And that for me is a dip. Sometimes I write, it's rare, I feel absolutely fantastic. But
I think it's just balance, isn't it? So, you know, there's this thing that we can't know anything unless we experience the opposite of it. So, you know, you haven't been forced to go to work at 9 to 5 for years now.
Yeah, like 8 years, yeah.
You know, and if you pondered on that and reflected on that a little bit, and what did it feel like when you were doing that, and how was your life like then, and what spare time did you have, and who were you socializing with, and what were you doing in the evenings, and blah, 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 and then compare it to now, that would give you a little bit of an improved lift of, you know, we forget how far we've come and how much we love what we've got. I was teaching a class on assertiveness the other day, on Tuesday, at a care home. And I was saying that the instant magic pill solution to everything is gratitude.
Right.
It's impossible to feel grateful and annoyed, or grateful and depressed, or grateful and scared. So no matter, or even in pain, actually, I've found lately, if you had pain, just get grateful about things and it sort of starts to fade away. It's good.
I have started writing gratitude in my journal this morning. I wrote, I am grateful that Jude, my son, is here at the house and he was playing really nice with Zia. And I'm really grateful for Liza for giving me this time to play with Jude. were taking care of Zia. So like there were some things today that were on my to-do list that I do with Zia on a weekly basis, and Liza took over that.
Yeah.
But I always feel super guilty then. And that guilt is like really toxic in our relationship as well. And that's something that I'm actually going to be working with Vinny on. It's like the guilt side.
Yeah, he's great. He'll help you out with that for sure.
Let's just do 10 minutes, if you don't mind, before we shoot off. Have you got 10 minutes?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so Kim from Australia. It's my Australian accent. Kim.
It's not your greatest skill.
No, it's not really. Kim is, let's have another bash that a minute. Wait there. Frau and have a shrimp on the barbie. No. Okay. Let's get that one up. So Kim is currently at the tail end of the taster. So the intensive. The intensive is split up into three different modules. The first module is truth. What's the truth about alcohol? The second module is awareness, raising our awareness of that truth. And the third is freedom. Now we're free of alcohol. What the hell do we do with our life? And that is where Kim is at the moment, okay?
Yeah.
So Kim is doing an exercise at the moment, a little bit like your how to help people figure out what's next, where to go, right? So probably we could talk about be, do, get for Kim at the moment. So she just did a little exercise and she's like, I really don't know what my vocation is. I don't really know what I want to do. I think I might want to be a writer, right? Okay. So then I've said to her, well, if you think you want to be a writer, buy the masterclass that's out there. It's £170 a year. Watch Neil Gaiman's masterclass on writing. Just listen to him. Don't really. It's not an interactive lesson. Just listen to it. See if it sinks you. And write every day. And see if you like it.
I want to be a writer. Writers write. Right. That's what I slap myself around the head with every day.
See if you like it. But she's struggling. Like a lot of people struggle. Like, I don't know what I want to do. So what advice would you give? How would you work with someone like Kim?
So the first thing I would do is understand, what drives her, who she's being again. So, you know, what is this dream that she's, who is she turning into that she wasn't before? What's her story? What's her life story? Because again, that's something we can easily write about and it has instant resonance, you know, because humans love to hear other humans' life stories. It's just, it's one of those great things. And then what does she currently read? What does she enjoy reading? What does she enjoy doing? And if she doesn't know, then I use a thing called idea circles. Again, it's in the book. But you start off in the middle of the page with anything, no matter how tenuous it is. So writing would be one thing to start off with. And you put writing in the middle and you draw a circle around it. Okay, so what can I write? I can write books. I can write articles. I can write on walls. I can write recipes. I can write to my relatives. I can write articles. I can write stories, you know, and just think as many things that you can, you know, what involves writing. And you surprise yourself at thinking of things. And as you go around and you're writing these things down, some of them hit you and your heart speeds up a little bit. It's the only way I can describe it. That's gold right there. So as soon as your heart speeds up and you think, ooh, that's a good sign.
Yeah, yeah.
So follow that one and then carry that one out. Now create another circle around it. So say your heart sped up at stories. I could write stories. Okay, what kind of stories can you write? I can write horror. I could write sci-fi. I could write true stories. I could write biographies. I could write my autobiography. You know, I think of as many stories as you could write. Okay, did your heart speed up on any of those? Yes, sci-fi. I love sci-fi. Okay, so I could write sci-fi stories. Okay, what kind of sci-fi stories can I write? Well, I can write about space travel. I can write about mind things. I can write about aliens. I could write, you know, and so on. And again, so you're just chunking down as you're going out on the circle down to what kind of thing excites you, and you're using your body as the way of judging, is that a yes or a no? We tend to feel yeses in the chest. So yes feels, so if you practice this, so you say yes, 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 yes. Think about things that you like to say yes to and say yes out loud a lot, and you'll feel it somewhere. So usually you feel it in your chest and it feels quite light and quite bubbly. Then think no. No, 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 no. And that feels really deep. Usually it feels like it's in your stomach. It feels quite heavy. It feels slightly nauseous to me. So if I'm ever doing anything, I'm looking for a yes or a no. As I go, right, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. I can get a feeling as I go around the circle or doing anything. In fact, I used to find a friend once.
All right.
It can develop into psychic skills if you practice it enough.
Right.
You can know the truth about anything. So practice your yes no's in the circle and then create another circle. So, okay, so we did that one. That was fun. Okay, what's another thing I like to do? What else do I like? I like food. Okay, food. I'm going to put food in the middle of the circle. So what can I do to do with food? Well, I could cook food. I could grow food. I could write recipes. I could take photos of it.
I could throw it in someone's face.
I could throw it in someone's face.
I could do a Kim Basinger, Mickey Rourke moment.
And so on. And then you go on. Now, it might be that our friend first says, oh, writing about food, that's come up twice for me. Okay, maybe that's something I should have a play with. And then the idea would be just have a go. Yeah. So what we do, and I am the biggest culprit of this, I love options. And whilst I've got a million options, then I'm quite happy to do nothing. Because this is the sad truth about solving problems, is people don't actually want you to solve them. They just want to know that they could solve them. Very, very irritating.
I like that. Yeah.
So once you can solve the problem, you need to have some way of forcing yourself very quickly into doing something about it, which is why I loved your story about, you know, writing. And you just wrote a column, you applied to a few people, and the first person said they weren't going to pay you, and you didn't care, you just went for it anyway, because at least it was a step in the right direction. And that is that momentum that you need right in the beginning, that what can I do? What can I just do now, right now? If I've decided that that's something I'm going to try and just do that thing right now. So I'm just going to draft out my first article, or I'm going to find three magazines that I like reading food recipes in, and I'm going to write to them and say, you know, are you interested in a blog about from me, you know, whatever, or do you hire writers, or I don't know, anything.
I think momentum is absolute key. I mean, everybody listening to this, you have to remember that I'm just a guy who decided to give up drinking around 2008, whenever it was. And then I said to myself, I need to help everybody else do the same. And then I said to myself, how am I going to do that? And then I said, well, the way I did it, I'll copy it for everybody else. And one of the ways I did it was, as soon as I quit drinking, what did I do? I quit my job. Then my wife quit me, which is a similar type of thing. And then I had to create a new job, right? Out of nothing. So I had momentum, like huge momentum. And I really believe, Kim, if you're listening to this, I know you are, that we talk about white space in Strive. For me, white space isn't, I took my dog for a walk today, I cleaned the stables out, I read a book, I watched a TV show, right? That is not white space, filling white space. It is, but it's not what I'm on about and why I like to teach it. White space is, what is it that I really, really want to do? What is my vocation? What is my meaning and purpose? And I'm going to spend time doing that. That is how I'm going to fill my white space. And Kim, when you find out what that is and writing it, it might be right, you're never going to drink again. Because you'll be so wrapped up in what you're doing and you'll have such a calling to it and it will feel so beautiful and wonderful and your body will be telling you this is the right thing to do, that drinking is just going to screw all that up. The reason that we drink is we don't really know what we're going to do.
It's escapism, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't like the feeling of not knowing our destiny and what we're going to do, so we drink because
destiny is a hard word for people, because, you know, people feel like destiny is save the world stuff. You know, I need to be doing, you know, I don't have the desire to do anything really important, but, you know, I really love cherry Bakewells.
Right.
I could have a really deep understanding of cherry Bakewell recipes, and I could think of three different ways of making a cherry Bakewell, you know, and I couldn't, by the way. But
well, I know there's cherry Bakewell tea. I played poker in Las Vegas last week, and there was an old guy in his 70s showing me photographs of his kid, like real photographs, not phone photographs, real photograph. Yeah. He had his photo album with him with a cherry Bakewell chapstick. So, wow. You know, there you are, cherry Bakewell.
Cherry Bakewell's a new thing. But that's what I mean. So destiny doesn't have to be, it's what I would say to Kim, don't think that this has to be some earth-shattering, meaningful, save-the-planet type thing.
Right.
I don't know how old Kim is, but if she's in rags-to-riches mode, this may be the first time she's tried to decide what she wants in her life. If she's already been there, then like you, she needs to reinvent herself. So actually, you losing everything was the best thing that could have happened to you because it forced you and gave you permission to completely reinvent yourself. So at 16, when I learned how easy it was to do this, was when I went to college and realized nobody from my school went there. So nobody knew I was the geeky bullied kid. And I thought, well, nobody knows that I'm not the most popular girl in the school I've just left. I could be the most popular, fascinating person and nobody would know. And so I got off the bus and thought, well, what would the most popular person do? Well, they just walk up to the nearest bunch of cool people and talk to them. And so I was shitting myself, but I did it.
Well done.
And when I was chatting to them, they were saying about what was going on in the first free period, and it was the radio. Before I knew it, I was saying, oh, I'd love to do the radio. And this girl looked at me like nobody had ever looked at me before and said, wow, you're so brave. I could never do anything like that. And in that moment, I thought, wow, she really thinks I'm that kind of person.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that point, I could have, you know, let the whole thing drop and go, neither could I, I'm terrified.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't, I kept on with it. And ran. Within about 3 weeks, I ran the radio station because the teacher had gone off sick and whatever. And I was the most popular person at college. But then it's a different lesson to learn, of course. So what I'm saying is, you know, that being a different person is really key here. So I think what we do with alcohol, we're trying to fill that gap with lots of do. And it's a noble thing to do. And it will distract you for a while. But until you're going to be something different, which doesn't include alcohol and doesn't need alcohol, and that's what's going to last. So you're bang on the money saying, you know, once you discover your thing, your passion, your meaning, you won't need the alcohol anymore. The alcohol's standing in at the moment, but it's not worthy. It's not worthy of your love. You're a crazy, divine, amazing being. And whatever you want to do, whatever that is, whatever you feel, whatever makes you happy, it's as simple as that. What makes you happy? And if you don't know what makes you happy, go try some stuff. Like think, well, you know, some people like rowing. Okay, I'm going to try rowing this weekend. Okay, no, I hated that. Right, okay, some people like running. I'm going to try running next weekend. No, I didn't like that either. Okay, some people like cooking. I'm going to try cooking. You know, just make, even if your time is spent trying things out and then going, no, I don't like that. No, I don't like that. Oh, I really enjoy dancing. Oh, my God, I love salsa dancing. I never knew. Who knew? Now I'm going to spend my time. I'm going to become a salsa teacher or I don't know, whatever. But follow your heart, follow what makes you happy. And, you know, and everything else just drops into place behind it.
Something else come up then. I lied on the 10 minutes. I'm going to take another 2 minutes of your time because it's so important. But something just come up. When you said the best thing that could happen to me was I lost everything. Well, I'm picking that. What happens when you lose everything actually is you become free, right?
Absolutely.
I have freedom. So then that got me thinking that, very often, maybe it might be worth trying to figure out what we're shackled to. Like, what is it that is constraining us? So let's say I want to be, like there are some people on Strive who like playing poker, right? Like, so they like playing poker. That's how they found me, through poker. You want to go play poker, right? But you might be shackled to the fact that you have like a household budget, right? Or maybe your husband, let's say you're a woman, want to play poker, and your husband's got all the money, and you've got to ask them, can you have money to play poker? And you might lose it, and you feel stupid and guilty. That's a shackle, right? I mean, do we feel like we are liberated enough in our relationships to be able to do what the hell we like? Like, are we able to just cook cherry Bakewells all day long? Are we able to just go on a silent meditation retreat? Are we able to, do we even feel comfortable asking our partner for £40 a month to be a member of Strive? Excuse me, I think I have an alcohol problem and I want to pay this guy £40 a month so I can join his community so I can learn to grow. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to support that. Even that in itself is a shackle. It can be very, very difficult.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that we put the shackles on before we ask. I was saying this on Tuesday to the group. One of the biggest tricks that I could ever teach the people in the UK about influencing and negotiating is just say what you want. Really, really simply. Don't add in because and you always and it's not fair and all these little justifications, because that's your shit, not their shit.
Yeah.
So just say what it is you want.
No and assumptions. I'm a terrible assumption creator because I think I think I'm some sort of Gandalf wizard that I can read people's brain. You know, like Liza say to me, "Don't fucking tell me what I'm thinking," and I'll be thinking to myself, "Yeah, but I know what you're thinking." Obviously, I don't, but I deluded myself into believing I do.
So tell if you know what she's thinking, then make it a game to delight her. How can you? So if she's thinking what she wants and it's horse riding, you know, over the sunset, then suggest it.
Well, let me end on this note. Let me end on this note, Liz, and see if your coaching has been worthwhile. So just before I came up here, Liza said to me, Saturday, Lee, we're going to Steiner Waldorf School to kind of have a look at it, see if it's a good school for Zia. However, I just seen that there's a festival going on, a music festival. Should we go to the music festival or should we go to Steiner? So I said, in typical Lee fashion, I don't know, you make a decision. I don't care either way. So then she goes and buys the festival tickets. Then she says to me, I bought the festival tickets, but I'm beginning to wonder whether I should have done it or not. To which I said, well, we haven't got any money, so why did you buy the festival tickets anyway in the first place?
Oh,
to which Liza says to me, why didn't you tell me that when I asked you? To which I said, well, I don't have to tell you those things. You should know that anyway. So then I clicked into it and said, the reason I didn't say anything is because I felt really guilty, because I want to be the best husband. I want you to really enjoy life, and I don't want to put barriers down in front of you. However, since talking to you, I've just said to myself, what we should do on Saturday is go to Steiner, look around the school, because that's super important for life. So I know it is. So I need to make it super important for me as well to show that I really care. And I do care. And I'm interested in my daughter's education. And then take them both to Llandaff Fields, get out the ghetto blaster, and then just have our own festival. Like, bit of like kombucha, some food, some real good tunes, and just rock it in the park. Boom.
Done. Sell the festival tickets for an extra 10% and you've made some money as well.
Done it. Liz, it's been a real pleasure. Really enjoyed it. I will make sure that everybody watching this knows where to find you and all that kind of stuff, but you can tell them if you want. Go on, tell them, where can we find you?
I'm at liztimoneyconsulting.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, is where I'm hang out most of the time with my little gang of worky people, because that's my big love. Or email me, liz@liztimoneyconsulting.com.
Awesome stuff, Liz. It's been fantastic. Thank you. I know I kept you a little bit longer than
that's
normal.
Fine. And have a lovely weekend with Lisa and Zia.
And you. Take care.
Take care. Bye.